You must not attempt this approach to parallels. I have traversed this bottomless night, which extinguished all light and joy in my life. I entreat you, leave the science of parallels alone. Two trains hurtle along tracks side by side, straining every rivet and bolt. It's neck and neck, one locomotive inching in front of the other before conceding ground. Crowds line the sidings, waving flags and cheering for their favorite engine in this unusual race. Then, the unthinkable happens. Gasps ring out as the trains smash into each other, metal folding like paper as they burst into flames. But how could this have happened? After all, the tracks the trains were racing along were parallel. The very definition of parallel lines is that they will never meet, no matter how far you extend them. So how could they have come together? Mathematicians have studied parallel lines for millennia. Among the earliest to juggle with these ideas was the Greek polymath Euclid, often referred to as the father of geometry. Euclid penned one of the most influential books ever written, Elements, containing many of the rules that underpin mathematics to this day. And the fifth of these rules is called the parallel postulate. This effectively states that two trains traveling along parallel tracks should never, ever meet. The other four postulates were quickly proven, but the parallel postulate remained evasive, going unproven for almost 2,000 years. Until, finally, in the 19th century, mathematicians dropped an existential bombshell. The postulate hadn't been proven because it couldn't be. Two parallel lines could meet, after all. Suddenly, Euclidean geometry was no longer the only game in town. It became possible to bend and contort space in ways that completely upend the usual rules. But what does this mean? And why does this matter outside of mathematics? The answer, as we will see, is truly bizarre. For today, non-Euclidean geometry lies at the heart of one of the most fundamental questions in the universe. A cosmic question close to the top of the list of those most asked to astronomers. Our journey towards answering this question will take us to bizarre, twisted universes where light loops round and we can see the same galaxies multiple times in the sky. It will guide us through universes folded over on themselves, universes where if you look hard enough, you may see yourself staring back, and universes where parallel lines meet again and again and again. It is a trip that will defy common sense, but is guaranteed to leave you with a much deeper understanding of the cosmos in which we live. And the question we will be answering? If the universe is expanding, just what is it expanding into? In medieval Naples, Pope Innocent IV lies on his sickbed. The pontiff's advisors have just delivered the crushing news that his papal forces have been overrun by Manfred, the King of Sicily. This devastating development is widely credited as the reason for his death just days later, at the age of 59. And yet, in some circles at least, there are growing whispers that the Pope's early demise came from an entirely different source. That he was, in fact, murdered. The proposed culprit? The ghost of a little-known English bishop with whom he'd clashed time and again, a clergyman by the name of Robert Grosseteste. This supposed spiritual assassin was born in the 13th century and rose to become the bishop of the English cathedral city of Lincoln. Quarrelsome and restless, he sought reforms to the Catholic Church that would bring him into direct conflict with Pope Innocent IV as well as King Henry III. Yet it is Grosseteste's contributions to the fledgling field of modern science that are far more noteworthy today. For he was a particularly early advocate of the scientific method and the crucial role of experiment in revealing the hidden laws that invisibly govern our world. begin with, Grosseteste was the first person in history to correctly explain rainbows as the result of the refraction of light. And light became somewhat of an obsession and played a central role in his version of something bishops and cosmologists both fixate on: the creation of the universe. According to Grosseteste, the universe began when light expanded outwards from a central point before condensing to matter. This was a full 7 centuries before modern astronomers would hit upon a similar notion. And so today, Grosseteste is known in some circles as the Big Bang Bishop. Grosseteste died in 1253 and is buried in Lincoln Cathedral. Miracles were reported at his shrine, and he was widely considered a saint in England as a result, although Grosseteste's sainthood was never ratified by the Vatican, in large part due to the rumor that his ghost murdered the Pope. But as we know, Grosseteste's idea for an expanding universe would not be developed in the following years. Indeed, it would take more than half a millennia for it to raise its head again. And interestingly, it was another Catholic man of the cloth that would ultimately rekindle Grosseteste's idea in the early 20th century: the Belgian priest, Georges Lemaître. Lemaître was lucky to even be alive at this point. As an artillery officer at Ypres during the First World War, he narrowly escaped the horrors of a cloud of chlorine gas when the wind changed and blew it away from him. Then, in the Second World War, the Americans accidentally bombed his home. In 1927, Lemaître published his solutions to the equations of Einstein's general theory of relativity, our best and most complete theory of gravity. He wasn't the first to do this, people had been doing it for years. Indeed, Karl Schwarzschild had been one of the first more than a decade earlier, using his solution to propose the idea of black holes. Lemaître's solutions, however, were different. They implied that the entire universe was expanding. But most ignored his findings. Einstein was among those who were brutally dismissive. "Your calculations are correct, but your physics are abominable," he said. Einstein famously would go on to tweak his own equations to maintain a static universe. However, the seeds of the proof that Lemaître was right had already been sown, for in 1915, the American astronomer Vesto Slipher had announced his discovery that galaxies appeared to be running away from us. Slipher reached his landmark conclusion thanks to measurements of redshift, one of the most important weapons in an astronomer's armory. First, take light from a galaxy and break it up into its constituent colors, much like Grosseteste correctly assumed raindrops do to create rainbows. Second, look for the dark bands hidden in this spectrum that represent missing colors swallowed by the various chemical elements that make up the galaxy. Finally, measure how far this pattern of lines has been shunted towards the red end of the spectrum. The more pronounced this redshift, the faster the galaxy is receding from us. This was only one half of the puzzle, however. The final missing piece would be provided by Edwin Hubble in 1929. He measured the distances to galaxies before comparing them to the speeds with which the galaxies are fleeing. In doing so, he found a very strict pattern now known as Hubble's Law. The further a galaxy is from us, the faster it appears to be running away. How fast? According to modern measurements, about 23 kilometers per second for every million light years. That means there are galaxies in the universe moving away from us faster than the speed of light. And so Hubble immediately knew that Lemaître was right. The universe is expanding after all, just as the visionary Grosseteste had suspected centuries before. Despite how often it's talked about, it's not always immediately obvious why the fact that more distant galaxies are fleeing from us faster automatically means that the universe must be expanding. So let's nail the link with a more familiar example of something else that expands: bread. Bread with raisins in it, to be precise. Imagine mixing and kneading dough before placing it in an oven for an hour to bake. In that time, it will double in size and give you a tasty treat. But now, imagine placing yourself on one of the raisins and looking around at the other raisins as the dough rises. A raisin that was initially 1 centimeter away from you will end up 2 centimeters away at the end of the baking time. It will have moved 1 centimeter an hour. If a raisin was already 2 centimeters away from you to begin with, then it will end up 4 centimeters away, moving at an apparent speed of 2 centimeters per hour. A third raisin, initially 3 centimeters away, would finish the bake 6 centimeters distant, apparently moving at 3 centimeters per hour. In other words, the bigger the initial gap between you and the raisin, the faster you'll see it moving away from you. Why? Because the dough is expanding. It's not that the raisins are moving through the dough, nor is more dough somehow being added. Instead, the gap between the raisins is stretched by the existing dough's expansion. The more dough there was between you and a raisin to begin with, the more pronounced the effect of its expansion. And Hubble's law offers up an identical explanation for galaxies. As Slipher realized, most appear to be running away from us, but the galaxies themselves aren't fleeing through space. Instead, the space between the galaxies is expanding and carrying them ever further from us. The more space there was to begin with, in other words, the further a galaxy is from us, the faster it will appear to move away. No new space is being added, merely existing space, stretched. This is allowed by general relativity. Space and time are malleable, inconstant things. And it is this expansion of the universe that is also responsible for the more pronounced redshift of more distant galaxies spotted by Slipher. As the light waves travel towards Earth, they are stretched as the space they traveled through expands. Of all the colors of the rainbow, red light has the longest waves, and so the more space the light has to travel through to get here, the closer to the red end of the spectrum the spectral lines will appear. This is a good illustration of another subtle point that often vexes people when it comes to fully understanding an expanding universe. People often ask what happens to energy as the universe expands. Energy conservation is one of the most famous laws of physics, stating that energy can't be created or destroyed and that the total energy of a system must stay the same. However, energy is not conserved in an expanding universe. The energy conservation rule holds for the kind of physics covered by Isaac Newton's 3 famous laws of motion, where particles move through a benign background space that isn't changing. However, space is constantly changing in an expanding universe, and so the total energy of the particles moving through it is not conserved in the same way. Redshifted light is a perfect example. As the expansion stretches out the light waves, they lose energy. The total energy of all the photons reaching Earth decreases. It is not conserved. And this expansion of the universe also leads to another curious effect. Light from the most ancient events takes longer to arrive as it has had to travel a long way through an expanding universe to get here. The result is that the oldest objects in the universe appear to evolve almost 5 times more slowly than the same events today. And so the fact that the universe is expanding is clear. But when exactly did this expansion start? Well, if the universe is getting bigger day by day, then it was smaller yesterday. It was smaller still a century ago, and yet more minuscule nearly a millennium ago when Grosseteste's ghost was supposedly seeing off the Pope. It is Hubble's law that tells us how much expansion there has been since the Big Bang. Rewinding the clock on this expansion tells us when the expansion started. Indeed, this little piece of nothingness is what Lemaître called the primeval atom, but today astronomers call it the Big Bang. And rewinding Hubble's law timestamps the beginning of this expansion at around 13.8 billion years ago. The very name of the event, the Big Bang, calls to mind some kind of explosion, one that continues to drive the ongoing expansion of the universe even to this day. Understandably then, people ask astronomers for the location of this explosion, to point them to the place in the universe where the Big Bang banged. Where is the center of the universe? After all, if a bomb exploded in a room, then investigators sent in the aftermath could piece together the necessary clues from the shrapnel and debris to work out where in the room the bomb went off. So why can't the same be done with the Big Bang? Well, the Big Bang created the universe. If a bomb exploded, and in doing so created a room, then it would make no sense to ask where in the room that bomb detonated. After all, the room didn't exist before the explosion. In an expanding universe, everyone thinks that they are at the center of the expansion, when in fact, there is no center at all. And so, it's clear that the universe isn't expanding from anywhere. But then, what is it expanding into? This is one of the other questions most frequently asked of astronomers, but also one that turns out to be much trickier to answer than it first appears, with deep and profound consequences for the way we understand the universe. The view is magnificently monochrome as you hurtle high above the surface of the moon. Prehistoric craters, smooth lava plains, soaring mountains, and spindly volcanic rills jut and spread as far as the eye can see. An ancient, empty wasteland, touched only by 12 pairs of American boots in billions of years. And flying over the jagged lunar landscape is more than just breathtaking. It's also a journey through the history of science. You'll find crater after crater named after the most towering figures to ever contemplate the cosmos. Indeed, this roll call of celestial greatness includes Einstein, Hubble, Slipher, and Lemaître. But it also includes two craters that sit on opposite sides of the moon, one on the northern near side and the other on the southern far side. Their geographical juxtaposition is apt because the two physicists they are named after, Wilhelm de Sitter and Hermann Minkowski, also lend their names to opposing possibilities for the shape of our universe. Indeed, which one turns out to be correct governs whether or not the cosmos will ever end, and has important consequences for our question of what exactly the universe is expanding into. Minkowski was once Einstein's professor. They didn't always see eye to eye, however. He's a lazy dog who never bothered about mathematics at all, Minkowski once said of the most famous scientist who has ever lived. Indeed, Minkowski was far closer to the legendary German mathematician David Hilbert, who wrote a touching obituary of his friend. Referring to their shared scientific work, Hilbert said, "It seemed to us a garden full of flowers. In it, we enjoyed looking for hidden pathways and discovered many a new perspective that appealed to our sense of beauty. And when one of us showed it to the other and we marveled over it together, our joy was complete." Wilhelm de Sitter, on the other hand, was born in 1872 to a judge, the latest in a long line of lawyers stretching back generations. However, Wilhelm would abandon enforcing the rule of law for a chance to understand the hidden rules of the universe. When he died of pneumonia in 1934, the New York Times wrote of him, "He's not a cold, dispassionate juggler of Greek letters, a balancer of equations, but rather an artist. Only the musician can fully grasp what it must have meant to De Sitter to see the cosmos shaping itself in new ways in his formulas." And it is for their work on the overall shape of the universe that the two men are most remembered today. Minkowski space and De Sitter space are different ways to describe the way in which the fabric of the universe curves. Minkowski space is usually referred to as flat, which is not intuitively the clearest way to describe it, because to astronomers and mathematicians, flat doesn't necessarily mean two-dimensional, like a flat sheet. Instead, it refers to space that has zero intrinsic curvature. Indeed, shortly, we'll encounter multiple examples of flat shapes that are very much three-dimensional. Shapes drawn in Minkowski space follow the rules of Euclidean geometry. Euclidean geometry may sound unfamiliar, but it is the bedrock of high school mathematics. Triangles drawn in Minkowski space, for example, have angles that add up to 180 degrees, just as our teachers repeatedly try to drum into us. Parallel lines stay parallel forever. What your teachers probably didn't tell you, though, is that this isn't true, for for all triangles. And to see why, let's return to the moon. Imagine yourself atop the lunar North Pole. You travel down towards the lunar equator, crossing the De Sitter crater on the way. Upon reaching the equator, you take a 90-degree turn, travel along the equator for a while, then take another 90-degree turn that sets you back on a path to your starting point on the North Pole. Your entire journey traces out a triangle across the craggy lunar surface. However, the base of this triangle already has two angles each equal to 90 degrees. The other angle at the North Pole is not zero, and so the angles in this triangle must add up to more than 180 degrees. In fact, it's possible for a triangle drawn on a sphere to contain up to 540 degrees. And this is an example of non-Euclidean geometry. A similarly shaped universe is referred to as closed. Just like circumnavigating the moon or the Earth, even if you travel in a straight line, you'd eventually loop back round and return to where you started. Space with this kind of positive curvature is known as De Sitter space. But that is not it. There is a third possibility. Anti-De Sitter space. In this version of non-Euclidean geometry, the angles in a triangle add up to fewer than 180 degrees. Shapes like a saddle or the potato-based snack Pringles have this negative curvature. It pinches the angles in the triangle, meaning that they sum to under 180 degrees. A universe shaped like this is referred to as open. So of this trio of options, which kind of universe do we live in? Closed, open, or flat? We can imagine a spacecraft tracing a giant triangle in the sky in an attempt to answer this question. They could fly for millions of light years across the universe before returning to the Earth, a mega version of the triangle we drew on the lunar surface. If, like on the moon, they needed to turn through more than 180 degrees to complete the triangle, we'd be able to conclude that the universe is positively curved. If they managed to pull it off by traveling through fewer than 180 degrees, then that would indicate negative curvature. Only if their triangular path contained exactly 180 degrees would the universe be flat. Unfortunately, no astronauts have yet ventured further than the moon, and even our most distant spacecraft won't reach the nearest stars for tens of thousands of years, let alone leaving the galaxy and flying for millions of light years. But thankfully, there is something else that has already travelled across the universe for billions of light years. The light from the cosmic microwave background. The leftover radiation from near the beginning of the universe. Look at a map of the cosmic microwave background, and it's speckled with tiny temperature variations. Small regions a little hotter or cooler than the average. They correspond to areas of the baby universe that were a little denser or sparser. Indeed, these regions were the seeds from which structure in the adolescent universe emerged. Denser regions gradually pulled in more material to construct huge superclusters of galaxies. Empty regions became larger as a result, fashioning enormous supervoids. Knowing the expansion history of the universe from Hubble's law, astronomers can work backwards from the megastructures in the modern universe to predict the size of the speckles in the CMB. The answer they get matches their observations perfectly. And this tells us the light from the CMB has travelled through a flat universe to reach us, one governed by the rules of Minkowski space. But that is not quite the end, for astronomers still have to try and work out what's called the topology of the universe. To understand what is meant by topology, imagine two shapes, each made out of modeling clay. If you can remold one of the shapes into the other without tearing the clay, then the two shapes share the same topology. A donut, for example, is a match for a teacup. The hole in the handle of the cup can be reworked into the hole in the center of the donut without needing to make any tears. As an example, the universe could resemble a giant sheet of paper. But if you curl that sheet up, you get a cylinder, and if you join the ends of the cylinder together, you get a donut, a shape mathematicians call a torus. All of these topologies are considered flat because the angles in any triangle drawn on them add up to 180 degrees. There are, however, a total of 18 different 3D topologies consistent with a flat universe that follow the rules of Euclidean geometry. Of course, by far the simplest option is the first. That, like an endless, stretched out piece of paper, the universe just continues on and on, forever. An infinite universe. That is impossible for a closed universe. As we've seen, you'll always end up back where you started. And if the universe is indeed infinite, then it isn't expanding into anything. It can't be getting bigger to occupy more space, as the space that's there is already infinite. But is the universe really infinite? Not in some of the other topologies that fit with our observations of the cosmic microwave background and the apparent flatness of the universe. Take one of them, a shape known as the Three Torus. Imagine taking an ordinary cube, then bending a pair of opposite sides around and gluing them together. Then do the same for the other two pairs of sides. The result is a Three Torus. If the universe is shaped like this, then travelling away from the Earth in a straight line would eventually see you return to the Earth on a finite closed loop. Other flat topologies also have these closed loops, including the so-called Hantzsch-Wendt manifold. It can be constructed by starting with two cubes stuck together, then bending the different faces around to join one another. If the universe really has such closed loops, then we could be living in a cosmic hall of mirrors. Light following a closed loop could result in us seeing the same object in different parts of the sky as its light is bent back round. Indeed, astronomers have been looking for repeating connected patterns in the cosmic microwave background, but are yet to see anything significant. So it remains hard to say if the universe is infinite or not. The Hantzsch-Wendt manifold has received particular attention because its complex geometry would actually obscure the repeating patterns, which might be why astronomers haven't seen them. To make matters worse, astronomers aren't even 100% sure that the universe is actually flat. Strictly speaking, astronomers have used the cosmic microwave background to measure the flatness of the observable universe, the bit they are able to see. There is thought to be more universe beyond this imaginary boundary. And so this leaves astronomers with two competing options. The first is that the entire universe is flat. The bit that they can see, and the bit that they can't. However, when astronomers calculate the odds of this happening, they are astronomically small. The alternative is that the Big Bang has expanded the universe to such a degree that any curvature the observable universe initially had was ironed out. This is similar to how the Earth appears to be flat beneath your feet, despite the fact that the Earth's surface is curved. That curvature is only noticeable above a certain scale, and in the cosmos, that scale could well be beyond the edge of the observable universe. Except, Hubble's law tells us how much expansion there has been since the Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago, and there simply hasn't been enough to completely smooth out the observable universe. The most commonly accepted fix to this problem is a theory known as cosmic inflation. This theory injects a period of super rapid expansion in the universe's first fractions of a second over and above Hubble's law. Inflation also explains those tiny speckles in the cosmic microwave background, which shouldn't be there according to the original Big Bang theory. According to inflation, the speckles are the result of tiny quantum fluctuations frozen into the universe forever when it suddenly ballooned in size. Finding definitive evidence for inflation would put the possibility of a non-flat, and therefore finite universe, firmly back on the table. Yet, with that, the nagging question of what the universe is expanding into re-emerges. Although, as it turns out, we don't necessarily need for it to be expanding into anything at all. Thank you. It is the late 1780s. The United States of America has yet to reach its teenage years. France is about to descend into a chaotic revolution that would eventually see King Louis XVI meet the business end of a guillotine. And meanwhile, in Germany, a young schoolboy by the name of Carl Friedrich Gauss is sitting in a classroom listening attentively in a mathematics lesson. The teacher has just set the students a task. They must add up all the numbers from 1 to 100. Within seconds, Gauss pipes up, 5,050, sir. The teacher's jaw drops faster than King Louis's guillotine blade. It's unclear whether this actually happened. The story has joined the annals of other likely apocryphal tales in the history of science. Think Archimedes running naked down the street, or the apple falling on Newton's head. But the trick to arriving at 5,050 within just a few heartbeats is to realize that you don't actually have to tediously add up all the numbers. Instead, you pair the numbers off. 1 with 100, 2 with 99, 3 with 98, and so on. Each pair will always add together to make 101. With 50 such pairs, all the young Gauss had to do was multiply 101 by 50 and arrive at the correct answer of 5,050. Whether it happened or not, the anecdote is designed to illustrate Gauss's precocious talent for mathematics, even from a tender age. He would go on to become one of the most influential, if not the most influential, mathematicians of all time. And Gauss's work would eventually become a cornerstone of the way we understand the universe, what it truly means to say that it is expanding, and whether or not it needs to be expanding into anything. Earlier, we used the analogy of raisin bread to explain the expanding universe. An inflating balloon with coins stuck onto its surface to represent galaxies is another analogy that's often used. As you blow up the balloon, the galaxies move further apart as the rubber between them stretches. In the same way, we do not expand with the expanding universe. So tight are the shackles of our atomic bonds. However, all of these everyday analogies for an expanding universe have their limitations. In both scenarios, the object is still expanding into something, either the oven or the room. And so to understand how the universe itself can expand without needing to expand into anything, we need to enter a baffling branch of mathematics known as differential geometry. To begin with, imagine a two-dimensional sheet that's then rolled up into a cylinder. To achieve this, you have to curve the sheet through a third dimension that's beyond the sheet itself. Mathematicians call this external dimension the embedding space. Now, let's imagine that our universe is shaped like this cylinder, and that intrepid astronauts are tracing a giant triangle across its surface. The angles in that triangle would add up to 180 degrees, just as they would on the original flat sheet. From the astronauts' point of view, they'd be unable to tell the difference between the flat sheet and the cylinder. That is, unless they could somehow leave the surface of the cylinder entirely and look back on it from the embedding space. Only then could they see it was curved. Shapes like this are said to have extrinsic curvature. The curvature is only apparent from beyond the surface of the shape. And to say this another way, a cylinder has no intrinsic curvature. And in mathematics, intrinsic curvature is also known as Gaussian curvature, because Gauss would make a huge breakthrough in differential geometry in 1827. Shapes with no intrinsic curvature, including cylinders, are regarded as flat. You can see why it's a bit confusing. However, some shapes do have intrinsic curvature, and the most obvious example is the sphere. As with traveling across the moon, you don't have to leave the surface of a sphere in order to know that it's curved. The fact that the angles in a large triangle add up to more than 180 degrees tells you that you're on a curved surface without the need for an embedding space. And when Gauss published the details of this idea in 1827, it became known as Theorema Egregium, Latin for remarkable theory. An interesting consequence of the fact that a sheet has zero Gaussian curvature, but a sphere doesn't, is that all the maps of the world or off. Indeed, a 2D map of a 3D sphere will always be distorted. The most common world maps use the Mercator projection, which is designed to preserve the angles between objects and make navigation easier. However, that means that areas are skewed. Greenland, for example, appears 14 times larger than it really is. There are ways to preserve areas and skew angles instead, such as the Lambert cylindrical equal area projection, but Gauss's remarkable theory tells us that something always has to give. But so far, we have spoken about hypothetical cylinders and spheres and maps of the Earth. What about the real universe in which we live? Fast forward to 1857, and a 76-year-old Gauss is in the audience for a lecture given by one of his former protégés, Bernhard Riemann. Born in Hanover the year before Gauss published his remarkable theory, Riemann initially set his sights on studying theology, but ended up studying mathematics instead under Gauss's tutelage at the University of Göttingen. Indeed, Gauss once remarked that Riemann had a gloriously fertile originality. In his 1857 lecture, Riemann set out to extend Gauss's work on differential geometry beyond three dimensions. Today, this is known as Riemannian geometry, and, as we will see, it would prove a crucial breakthrough. One of the most important concepts in Riemannian geometry is the geodesic, a line that represents the shortest path between two points on a curved surface, which often leads to odd-looking outcomes when you step down a dimension. Take, for example, the more than 30 flights that travel between London and New York every day. London sits closer to the North Pole than New York, so you'd think that a plane flying to the Big Apple would set off from the UK and head south. In fact, it heads north, flies in a straight line, and still ends up further south. This straight line across a three-dimensional surface looks curved when drawn on a two-dimensional map. And perhaps even more bizarrely, it's actually possible to travel in a completely straight line from Alaska to India without ever flying over land. When drawn on a 2D map, this journey looks about as far from straight as it's possible to get. However, looking at that path from space, and you can clearly see how straight it is. And these ideas, geodesics and Riemannian geometry, would go on to form the backbone of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, our best-tested explanation of gravity. General relativity says that the three dimensions of space and one dimension of time are irrevocably woven together into a four-dimensional fabric called space-time. Indeed, it was Einstein's grumpy professor, Hermann Minkowski, who actually coined the term. This means that Gaussian differential geometry, which can only describe curvature in a total of three dimensions, is not sufficient. Only Riemannian geometry, which generalizes Gauss's work to any number of dimensions, works. According to general relativity, the presence of massive objects curves four-dimensional space-time, and it is this curvature that's responsible for the apparent force of gravity. Earth, for example, doesn't orbit the Sun because there's an invisible force of attraction between them, as Isaac Newton had suggested in the 17th century. Instead, the Sun distorts the fabric of space-time around it, and the Earth is caught rolling around in this distortion. However, thinking of gravity in this way leads to what appears at first to be a controversial statement, that the Earth orbits the Sun in a straight line. At least, that's true in four dimensions. Just as the straight London to New York flight path across a 3D surface appears curved when drawn on a 2D map, the Earth's straight path through 4D space-time only appears curved in three dimensions. And this curvature is particularly apparent in an effect known as gravitational lensing. When light from a distant source encounters a massive cluster of galaxies, the light's path appears to bend around it. Riemannian geometry allows astronomers to estimate the amount of space-time curvature required to do this, in turn leading to an estimate for the total mass of the cluster. Usually, there appears to be considerably more mass than can be accounted for by adding up all the visible material in the cluster, strongly hinting to astronomers that the difference is made up of invisible, dark matter. And so, this all means that thanks to the use of Riemannian geometry, general relativity can completely describe space-time, our universe, and its expansion in terms of intrinsic curvature alone. There is no need for an external embedding space, and so no requirement for the universe to be expanding into anything. However, as you might have guessed, that is not quite the end. For just because the universe doesn't need to be expanding into anything, doesn't mean that it isn't. After 7 long months travelling through the solar system, it is the next 7 minutes that will decide the fate of NASA's Perseverance rover. Hurtling through the thin Martian atmosphere at almost 20,000 kilometers per hour, from the planet's surface it looks like a giant shooting star lighting up the daytime sky. Suddenly, the parachute pops and flutters open. The rover rig emerges from its protective chrysalis, stabilized in midair by a series of thrusters and finally dangling down from the sky crane on long, puppet-like wires. With the rover safely on the surface, the sky crane powers away so as not to contaminate the pristine environment around Jezero crater that the mission has traveled almost 500 million kilometers from Earth to explore. Landing a car-sized rover on a distant planet is no mean feat, yet this mission has another, even more impressive achievement up its sleeve. A miniature helicopter. Known as Ingenuity, it would go on to make the first powered flight on another world. In fact, it would make a total of 72 flights, despite only being designed for 5. Endeavors like this are a stark reminder of just how weak the force of gravity really is. Despite the heft of an entire planet, this tiny aircraft, with a fuselage the size of a tissue box and weighing no more than a bag of potatoes, could climb over 20 meters above the dusty Martian surface. And as well as this, of the 4 fundamental forces, gravity also has the dubious honor of being the least understood, even though its rules were discovered centuries before those of the other 3. Indeed, this is even more perplexing, considering that gravity is the force that most obviously affects our day-to-day lives. To underscore the disparity between gravity and the other forces, imagine 2 electrons. Their gravitational attraction is 100 tretacillion times weaker than the repulsive electromagnetic force between them. That's a 1, followed by a staggering 43 zeros. This gulf in their might is particularly troublesome because physicists assume that all 4 fundamental forces were once united into a single force immediately after the Big Bang, before peeling away from each other in the universe's first slivers of a second. Indeed, there is already concrete evidence that the electromagnetic and weak forces were once the electroweak force, and the rules that describe the strong force are so similar to those belonging to the electroweak that they appear a perfect fit. We just haven't ramped up the energy of particle accelerators enough yet in order to find proof. But gravity, however, remains firmly out in the cold. As we've seen, it's described by Einstein's general theory of relativity instead, a theory that doesn't play nicely with the quantum field theories we used to describe the other 3 forces. And so, if all 4 forces were once equal in strength, what happened to relegate gravity to such a lowly footing? Well, the answer could lie in a sci-fi sounding branch of physics known as the brain world, a truly bizarre theoretical example of an embedding space. According to these theories, our 4-dimensional space-time is merely a surface, or brain, embedded in a higher dimensional hyperspace known as the bulk. The word brain is a shortened form of membrane. Perhaps the easiest way to picture this is to drop down a dimension. Imagine an ant crawling around the surface of a hollow sphere, floating in mid-air. That ant would be confined to a 2D surface, a brain, embedded in a 3D bulk. And in the same way, we could live on a 4D surface embedded in a bulk with at least 5 dimensions. This brain world has its roots in string theory, which is one attempt to unite gravity with its fellow forces. According to string theory, subatomic particles are made of tiny vibrating strings. And within this theory, just as you can play stringed instruments in different ways to create different notes, so nature plays these strings to create different particles. And a family of particles called bosons is particularly important because they are responsible for carrying forces. Indeed, it is only by exchanging bosons that magnets can attract or repel each other, for example. Atomic nuclei are only held together by the strong force because bosons called gluons are being exchanged between their constituent parts. Physicists have already experimentally verified the bosons behind three of the four fundamental forces, but they have yet to discover one linked to gravity. If it does exist, this graviton is proving particularly hard to find. Despite its elusiveness, the graviton could be the key to unlocking the mystery of why gravity appears so much weaker than the other three fundamental forces, with huge implications for what the universe is expanding into. There are two types of string in string theory: open and closed. According to the brain world, open strings must always remain tethered to a brain at one end. Closed strings, however, which form a loop and so are effectively tethered to themselves, are free to wander through the full extent of the bulk. And the graviton is thought to be made of just such a closed string. In other words, the strength of gravity is diluted across both our brain and the bulk. The other three forces, with their open string bosons, are restricted to just the brain. And so if true, it's no wonder that we see gravity is considerably weaker than its fellow forces. It is leaking away into hyperspace. And there are ways to test this idea with experiments, even without the direct discovery of the graviton itself. It is possible that our atom-smashing efforts at places such as the Large Hadron Collider could create gravitons through the collision of ordinary particles. And if some of these gravitons wandered off into the bulk, they would leave behind telltale gaps in the data. Equally, physicists could also find evidence of gravity leaking into the bulk in modern versions of a famous 18th century experiment by Henry Cavendish, designed to measure the gravitational attraction between two nearby metal spheres. Forces usually follow what physicists refer to as an inverse square law. If you double the distance between two spheres, their gravitational attraction drops to a quarter. Treble the distance and it drops to a ninth. The same holds for the strength of the electromagnetic force between magnets. Now let's imagine that wandering gravitons are causing gravity to leak away into a single extra dimension. In other words, a five-dimensional bulk. Gravity's potency should fall away more quickly, and it will follow an inverse cube law instead. That means doubling the distance between two masses would see their attraction drop to an eighth instead of a quarter. In order to be consistent with the apparent weakness of gravity that we observe, this divergence from the inverse square law would show up over distances roughly equal to the gap between the Sun and the planet Uranus. And so clearly, astronomers would have noticed such a deviation by now. The orbits of the two outer planets would follow different gravitational rules to those of the inner planets. However, the more dimensions you add to the bulk, the more avenues there are for gravity to leak. This would lead to a greater deviation from the inverse square law as the strength of gravity drops even faster. But it would also reduce the distance over which this deviation becomes apparent. Indeed, for just two extra dimensions, it drops dramatically from a literally astronomical distance to a mere 0.3 millimeters. That may still sound relatively large, certainly compared to the size of atoms, but measuring gravity on this scale is currently beyond our capabilities. Though in 2021, a groundbreaking modern version of the Cavendish experiment did measure the gravitational attraction between two 90 milligram gold spheres separated by 40 millimeters. There was no deviation from the inverse square law. And so perhaps one day we will get this down to under 0.3 millimeters and finally see the proof of gravity leaking away into the bulk. Although, unfortunately, even if physicists did spot a deviation, it isn't smoking gun proof that our universe is a brain embedded in hyperspace. Instead, the extra dimensions that gravity is leaking into could be part of the universe itself, curled up so small as to remain out of sight. Proving the existence of the bulk would finally give us a more concrete answer to the question of what the universe is expanding into. Our 4D universe could be growing into a potentially infinite, higher dimensional hyperspace. But there is another potential way to use string theory in order to recreate rules similar to those of quantum physics, a groundbreaking discovery that goes by the rather dull name of the ADS-CFT correspondence. The ADS part is something we've encountered before, anti-de Sitter space. The CFT stands for conformal field theory. The quantum rules behind the standard model of particle physics, which exquisitely explain all of its subatomic particles and the forces that govern them, are close cousins of conformal field theories. And to better understand how the ADS-CFT correspondence works, let's take a three-dimensional example. First of all, imagine a disk that resembles an elaborate floor mosaic. It is made up of triangles and squares that follow the usual rules of anti-de Sitter space. As a reminder, that means the angles in the triangles add up to less than 180 degrees, and squares have angles that are pinched at the corners. Next, stack multiple copies of this disk on top of one another to form a cylindrical universe. This is an example of three-dimensional anti-de Sitter space. Measure the angles of a triangle anywhere within it, and they will add up to less than 180 degrees. But this cylinder has an unusual and critically important property. Put yourself at any point on the boundary, and the space immediately around you will follow the rules of Minkowski space instead. In other words, the boundary of this anti-de Sitter space is flat. And so given that the universe around us also appears flat, could our cosmos be the boundary of a higher dimensional anti-de Sitter bulk? That's the working idea behind the ADS-CFT correspondence. In theory, the bulk can have any number of dimensions, and the boundary will always have one fewer. But what's remarkable about the ADS-CFT correspondence is that if you apply string theory to a five-dimensional anti-de Sitter bulk, the resulting physics on the four-dimensional boundary are exactly the same as the rules of quantum physics. That's the correspondence part, a twinning of the physics of the bulk and the boundary. The two things are exactly equivalent. Except there are big caveats to consider. In the ADS-CFT correspondence, the four dimensions on the boundary are all dimensions of space. We do seem to live in a four-dimensional universe, but one of those dimensions is time. Only three are spatial dimensions. As well as this, the conformal field theory that appears on the boundary is a very close match to quantum physics, but not a perfect one. And so for now, the ADS-CFT correspondence is not a complete description of our reality. But when it was first proposed in the late 1990s by the Argentine physicist Juan Maldacena, it was a shot in the arm for an older theory known as the holographic principle. The hologram on the back of a credit card may give the illusion of looking three-dimensional, but in reality, all the information is encoded on a 2D card. Likewise, with the ADS-CFT correspondence, all the information about the 5D bulk is encoded on the 4D boundary. In fact, the ADS-CFT correspondence is sometimes called Maldacena duality for this very reason. It's also possible to take the same idea and drop down a dimension or two. Indeed, our universe seems to have three spatial dimensions, but could all the information about this universe actually be encoded on some distant 2D boundary? Could the whole cosmos be a hologram? It's certainly a tantalizing prospect, and one that helps physicists solve other thorny issues, such as what happens to information falling into a black hole. However, the holographic principle remains notoriously hard to test. yet it is a great illustration of the mental gymnastics and flights of fancy that physicists are willing to endure in the search for answers to one of the universe's greatest of questions. We've known for nearly a century that the universe is expanding. The work of Gauss and Riemann led us to Einstein, who told us that the universe doesn't need to be expanding into anything at all. And yet, the idea of higher dimensions just won't go away. Although should we ever find them, what is the universe expanding into certainly won't be the only monumental question being answered. You've been watching The Entire History of the Universe. Don't forget to like and subscribe and leave us a comment to tell us what you think. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.